35 to 40 years ago, the phrase midlife crisis emerged in the American vernacular. It's been described as a time of intense personal evaluation. And sometimes disturbing and frightening thoughts surge through the mind. We start questioning who we are, why we're here, why everything matters so much. Oftentimes, it's a time of self-doubt, disenchantment with everything, everything that's familiar, everything that's stable. The mind plays tricks on us. We entertain sometimes terrifying thoughts that we can't admit, we can't reveal even to those closest to us. We're tempted to think, I'm trapped in a life that is unfulfilling. I deserve a chance to make changes before it's too late, to discover my own identity, and to find personal happiness. And too often, a midlife crisis can lead to irrational thinking, impetuous purchases, and irresponsible relationships. Let me give you an example of what that looks like. A man sits in a physician's office. His life reads like an oft-told story. When John was in his early 20s, he married Mary, a beautiful and talented young woman. Mary was 3 years older than John. When she graduated from college, she went to work to put him through school. Once John completed his education, Mary bore two lovely children. She was an excellent mother, and not only had enough mothering for her daughters, but enough left over to give to John, who seemed to need and appreciate it. As John achieved success in his profession, they moved to a new house, and Mary, with her skill and taste, turned it into a comfortable home. Measured by conventional standards, John and Mary enjoyed success and possessed an ideal marriage. But about 3 years ago, something happened to John, and it devastated him. He turned 40. That birthday changed the way he looked at life. He began to notice television commercials for hair coloring, and he decided to touch up his graying temples. He noticed that tire around his middle, larger than the tires on his car, and determined to join a health club to work it off. He noticed some of the ads in men's magazines that told him how to dress and how to look young. And as a result, he went out and he purchased a whole new wardrobe and bought himself a sports car. At the office, John noticed a lovely 26-year-old receptionist. And she admired John. She listened to him. She certainly didn't mother him like Mary did. And John couldn't help but comparing her to Mary. Mary was 43 now. The bloom had kind of faded on her good looks. John was thinking of her as complacent and kind of unexciting, frankly, a little bit boring. So he began to fantasize about this receptionist. Pretty soon, thoughts turned to reality. He had an affair. But it wasn't anything what he had hoped or dreamed. He came away feeling guilty and depressed. Then he began to drink heavily. Alcohol, which in his teens was a badge of manhood, in his 20s a symbol of sociability, in his 30s an antidote to fatigue, now it was masking anxiety and a sense of futility. And today, John sits in a physician's office, and that's his story. But John isn't the patient. He's the physician. Change a few details, and that episode could characterize a business executive, a minister, an architect, an airline pilot. Ask men in their 40s, and even women for that matter, if they recognize themselves in John, and most of them will tell you, yeah, one degree or another, that's the story of our lives. John's experience has been called the midlife crisis. Some have even called it male menopause. Physiologically, that's not possible, but you get the idea. While no scientific poll has ever been taken to determine how often this happens, it appears rather widespread. Most men, if not all, experience this midlife syndrome or midlife crisis in some way or another. Now, we don't hear about midlife crisis as much these days as we did a generation ago, but doctors and psychologists recognize it's real. Scores of books and studies have been published. Maybe the best-known Christian book on the subject is called Men at Midlife Crisis, written by Jim Conway. Because this isn't just a physiological or psychological problem. In fact, I would argue that midlife crisis is primarily a spiritual issue. The root cause of it can be identified as a crisis of meaning. Because that's really what's at the root. People get to a point in their lives and they question, what does this all mean? Or does it mean anything at all? And in that we realize that a midlife crisis is not all that new. In fact, you see it very clearly in the pages of Scripture. Now, this isn't our text for this morning, but if you're at all familiar with the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, it is a journal of a man in midlife crisis. Here you have Solomon at the prime of his life and at the top of his game. He is the king. And he's not just the king of Israel, he is the wisest king ever to reign. He is the wealthiest king ever to reign. He has it all. He's not at war. Through his diplomacy, he has peace with the nations around him. He has expanded the borders. There is prosperity that's never been equaled. He has it all. And yet, he arrives, and I'm guessing it was probably during this midlife years, he gets to a point where he says, you know what, it's all meaningless. It just doesn't satisfy. It's not all it's cracked up to be. It's in the Hebrew. It's just kind of between the lines. He went through a midlife crisis. Now, our message this morning is not about Solomon and his search for meaning. We're continuing our study in the life and the teaching of Jesus. And this morning we come to an event, not in the life of Jesus so much, but in the lives of his closest friends. I hesitate to call it a midlife crisis because we tend to think of a midlife crisis as happening in your 40s. These guys may well have been in their 20s at this time. But it brings out an important truth. This crisis of meaning is not age dependent. It can happen really at any time in someone's life. It may even happen more than once. But they were faced with a situation that called their whole life into question. So I'm coining a new phrase today. They were going through a midst life crisis. It's just sometime in the midst of their lives. We don't know what it was. We don't know what age they were. But somewhere in the midst of their lives, they came to a situation. They came to a point in time where everything they thought that they knew was called into question. Everything they thought brought meaning and happiness and purpose to life was called into question. And they had to make a choice. And that choice would affect their lives from that point forward. So let's go to the fifth chapter of Luke's Gospel, the passage that was read earlier, those first 11 verses. While you're turning there, let me explain. There are similarities to an incident in Matthew and Mark, and then another incident at the end of the Gospel of John. I don't think any of these are the same. I think these are separate incidents that have some similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. So I think this is a unique incident recorded here in Luke chapter 5. The chapter begins, in most of your Bibles, it's going to say on the Lake of Gennesaret. And I'll bet probably none of you have ever heard of that before, but I'll bet you've all heard of the Sea of Galilee. And that's the same place, the Lake of Gennesaret. And that's, for whatever reason, Luke always calls it a lake. I don't know about you, but when I think of a sea, I think of really big, you know, Mediterranean Sea, something much larger. And in fact, the Sea of Galilee really was a lake. One of the commentaries I read said it measures roughly 13 by 7 miles. And I thought, I wonder what that compares to Clinton Lake. Turns out that the Sea of Galilee is a little bit larger than Clinton Lake. If you do it in acres, Clinton Lake's about 49,000 acres, and the Sea of Galilee is 58,000. So it's a little bit bigger, but not huge. It's not a whole lot. Maybe that give us a little bit of an idea about the size of the Sea of Galilee. And it was fresh water, by the way. It was a fresh water lake, you might say. Really good for fishing. And that's what a lot of the people in the area did for a living. They fished. Now, Luke tells us this story. Jesus is on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And quite a large crowd had gathered. They wanted to hear him teach. And Jesus noticed two fishing boats there on the shore. And the fishermen were on the beach. They were cleaning their nets. That's something they had to do every day. It was a common practice in those days to fish at night in the shallow waters close to shore. And then when morning came, you brought in your haul, sold the fish, cleaned your nets, and then went to bed so that you'd be ready for the next night of work. Well, there's one thing missing, as we're going to find out, about that particular story that day. But Jesus comes, there's two boats there, and he notices that they belong to some familiar faces. One of the boats belongs to a man named Simon. We know him as Simon Peter. This isn't the first time Jesus had met Simon. We saw back in John chapter 1, Simon's brother Andrew had brought Simon to Jesus and said, "Hey, this is the Messiah." At that time, John was also there, and his brother James fits into this story as well. So you have four men, Simon, Andrew, James, and John. They're all fishermen. They're partners in a fishing business, and they're there cleaning their nets. Their ships or their boats are put up on shore, and so Jesus approaches Simon and says, "Hey, could I take your boat just out a little ways into the water?" Simon said, "Sure." So they went out a little bit. The reason Jesus did that was so that the people could hear him. John Phillips explains, "The acoustical properties of the area is remarkable. The still water acts as a sounding board, kind of like a loudspeaker. It picks up the speaker's voice and throws it up the beach and the hillside so that everyone can hear what is being said, even when it's just spoken with a conversational tone of voice. The Lord did not even have to raise his voice to be heard by all of them." And I'm sure that Simon and the other three fishermen there kept on working on the nets while Jesus used his ship as a platform to address this large crowd on the shore. So we pick up the story now in verses 4 and 5. "When Jesus had finished speaking, he said to Simon, 'Put out into the deep water and let down the nets for a catch.' Simon answered, 'Master, we've worked hard all night. We haven't caught anything. But because you say so, I'll let down the nets.'" Jesus finished his teaching, looks at Simon and says, "Hey, let's go fishing. Take the boats out into the deep part of the lake here. Let's let down the nets for a catch." Peter says, I don't think so. "That's not how you do it. We fish at night, not in the heat of the day. We fish in the shallow waters, not out in the deep. Lord, you're a carpenter. You're a good one. But I'm a fisherman. Don't tell me how to fish." I can kind of relate to this. Not that it's happened to me, but I've witnessed it. Here. I won't mention any names so I don't embarrass anybody, but we have a couple guys in our church. One's an electrician and one's a plumber. And there are times when they're working here at the church at the same time. I had no idea what plumbers and electricians thought about each other till I listened to these two jab back and forth. Now I know it's all good-natured, but I sit back and chuckle. I think it's great. But I can imagine the same kind of thing happening here. Simon's thinking to himself, "Okay, Lord, you know, you're a carpenter. You're a good teacher. You stick to that. Leave the fishing to me," right? But he relents. "Okay, if you say so." In my research this last week, I came across a little passage, Max Lucado imagines how Simon would have retold this story. The last thing I wanted to do was fish. But that's what Jesus wanted to do. I had fished all night. My arms ached. My eyes burned. My neck was sore. It had been a long night. I don't know how many times we'd thrown that net into the blackness and heard it slap against the sea. I don't know how many times we held the twine rope as the net sank in the water. All night we waited for that bump, that tug, that jerk that would clue us to haul in the catch, but it never came. At daybreak, I was ready to go home. When Jesus finished teaching, he turned to me. I stood and begun to pull anchor, and he said, "Push out into the deep, Simon. Let's fish." I groaned. I looked at John. We're thinking the same thing. As long as he wanted to use the boat for a platform, that's fine. But to use it for a fishing boat, that was our territory. I started to tell this carpenter preacher, "You stick to preaching, I'll stick to fishing." But I was more polite. We worked all night. We didn't catch a thing. He just looked at me. I looked at John. John was waiting for my cue. I wish I could say I did it because of love. I wish I could say it I did it out of devotion, but I can't. All I can say is the time to question, there's a time to listen. So with as much a grunt as anything, I pushed out. With every stroke of the oar, I muttered. With every pull of the paddle, I grumbled, "No way. No way. Impossible. I may not know much, but I know fishing, and we're going to come back with some wet nets." Tell me you wouldn't have felt the same way. Tell me you wouldn't have been tempted to say the same thing. "Lord, you know preaching, but I know in whatever your area of expertise is, and he's asking you to go the total opposite of what you know to be true." But Simon got to the point of saying, "You know what, because you said so, okay." So they went out. Simon's reluctant consent led to a miraculous catch. Look at verses 6 and 7. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that the nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come out and help them, and they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. I guess you could say obedience brings results in a miraculous way. Simon tugged the nets and shockingly found the lines taut to the point of breaking. I'll bet the scene from shore was comical. You know, he's out there, "Oh, okay, let's do this." And all of a sudden, you know, his eyes get real big and he's yelling, calling for the other, "Bring that boat out here. We're about to drown." Get the other boat out there. They load both up with fish. Simon might have put it this way: we got the net in just before it began to tear. I've never seen such a catch. It was like plopping down a sack of rocks in the boat. We began to take in water. John screamed for the other boat to help us. It was quite a scene. Four fishermen and two boats, knee-deep in fish, and one carpenter sitting on the bow enjoying all the pandemonium. Don't think for a moment God doesn't have a sense of humor. I'm sure Jesus sat there on the bow of that boat with a grin, just thinking, "Oh, you have little faith." See, whenever we're tempted to doubt, God loves to do something to prove that there is nothing impossible with him. But most significantly, this led to a momentous change. Going back to Simon's supposed recollections, that's when I realized who he was. That's when I realized who I was. I was the one who told God what he couldn't do. "Go away from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man." There wasn't anything else I could say. I don't know what he saw in me, but he didn't leave. Maybe he thought if I let him tell me how to fish, I would let him tell me how to live. It was a scene I would see many times over the next few years. In cemeteries with the dead, on hillsides with the hungry, in storms with the frightened, on roadsides with the sick. The characters would change, but the theme wouldn't. When we would say, "No way," he would say, "My way." Then the ones who doubted would scramble to salvage the blessing, and the one who gave it would savor the surprise. And that's the way of Jesus, not just then, but also now. Notice the impact wasn't just on Simon. All four of them were shaken to the core by this event. In all their years of fishing, they'd never seen anything like this. But I want you to notice, Simon did not rush to Jesus and say, "Hey, how'd you do that? What's your secret? We could make a killing of a catch like this every night." No, he fell to his knees and he cried out, "Go away from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man." One writer comments, "We cannot stand in the presence of Jesus and see him clearly as the Holy One of God without becoming sensitive to the fact that we are sinners." A person who compares himself to other people can take some comfort in the fact that there are many who are worse than he is. But if we compare ourselves to Jesus Christ, we take no comfort at all. We know how far short we fall. And when this happens, our first reaction may be that of Simon, who felt both guilt and shame. His impulsive solution was to beg Jesus to leave. But if Jesus were to leave from us, we would be left with our problem of guilt and shame unresolved. See, Jesus did not do what Simon said. Remember last week, the man who was begging Jesus to come to Capernaum to heal his son? "Come, Jesus, you've got to come quickly. Come down to Capernaum." And Jesus said, "No, I'm not going with you." That doesn't mean that Jesus didn't heal his son. Sometimes God says no to our prayers because he has something better. And as I've oft quoted from that great theologian Garth Brooks, "Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers." Jesus didn't say to Simon, "Well, okay, if you say so, I'm out of here." What did he say to him? Notice the first words. "Don't be afraid." He's saying, "Stop being fearful." He's calming an existing fear. See, this happens when people came face to face with God and they took him seriously. It scared them out of their wits. Someone counted, there's 365 times in the Bible that it says, "Don't fear, don't be afraid, fear not." Happens a lot. We need to hear it a lot. But notice he says, "From now on." Jesus recognized that this was a turning point in their lives. And I also want you to notice that "you," he says "you" several times here, it's plural. He was talking to Peter, but he meant all of them. "From now on, there's going to be a change in your life. You will be catching men." Some of your Bibles say you will be fishers of men. See, they knew fishing. But he said, "I'm just going to change the catch." Even the verb is significant. The Greek word there for catch means to catch alive. See, when you caught fish and you brought them on shore, they died. When you catch men, you're actually getting people who are dead in their sins and bringing them to life. I think sometimes we as Christians need to be reminded of that. We're not hunting people like big game so that we can shoot them with the truth. Or beat them over the head with our Bibles. We are bringing people to life. But Jesus gave them a whole new purpose. And it was something that would bring meaning and satisfaction that nothing else could. And so verse 11 concludes, "They pulled up their boats on shore, they left everything and followed him." They had a good steady income. I don't want you to think that fishermen were the poor folks there in Galilee. It's very likely that Simon and Andrew, James and John had a very successful business going on. They were probably part of the upper middle class in Galilee. They had their own vessels. They had people that worked for them. Just like that illustration from the beginning of John. He wasn't some down and out, couldn't keep a job, poor bum on the street. He was the doctor. And more often than not, these midlife crises happen not to men who are failures, but to men who are successful, at least the way the world sees it. And you may be today at the height of your career, whatever that career might be. You may have it all that you could imagine, maybe even more so, and yet there's some nagging voice inside you that says, there's got to be more. It's like that old song from, I think, the 50s or 60s, is that all there is? We look around and we think, is there nothing else to life than this? Jesus gave them an opportunity not to become better fishermen, but to become fishers of men. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus is calling every one of you to quit your jobs tomorrow and go to Bible college. That's not the point. But what God's calling every single one of us to do is whatever we do, do it for the glory of God. Whatever we do, do it out of a love for God and a love for one another, not for the selfish accumulation of possessions. Because I want to tell you something, folks, if you haven't heard it before, and if you haven't come to realize it, you need to understand this. Stuff doesn't satisfy. And more stuff won't satisfy you anymore. Because all the stuff is going to get left behind. It's like that old saying goes, you'll never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. Because you can't take it with you. Now, we're appreciative of the stuff that we have, and it's not wrong to have stuff, but it's wrong if stuff has you. It's wrong if the pursuit of possessions possesses you. Jesus says, come to me, follow me, and you're going to find purpose. You're going to find meaning. And you know what? It may not be at the same economic level you're at. You may have to give up a full-time job with all of the perks and the benefits to follow Jesus. But take it from somebody who has. You won't regret it if that's the call of God on your life. And He may leave you right where you are. He may not tell you to change your job, change your career. He may use you right in that career, but it will revolutionize your life. It will change the way you think. And you will have a greater appreciation of what it means to live for God. Maybe you found yourself at such a point in your life. You're being challenged to do more, to be more. And maybe you're in those midlife years. What is midlife anyway? I just turned 50. I hope I'm at midlife. Probably not. I'm probably on the way down. We all like to think we're going to, you know, live a long, long time. We don't know. We don't know what the middle of our life is. So let's call it what it really is. We're in the midst of life. And frankly, it doesn't matter how long your earthly life is. Fact is, you have a chance right now to choose to follow God. To live by the instructions. This last week I was here. Richard was working on one of the lights. And he opens the box and he pulls out this piece of paper and he's opening it up. And I said, you actually read those? They were the instructions. And yes, he does. He's one of the few. Most men think, nah. Then after an hour of messing everything up, where are those instructions at? Right? It works better when you put it to use the way the Creator designed it, right? The same is true for us. When we live our lives according to the way our Creator designed us, we're going to find it much more fulfilling, a lot less frustrating. Jesus says, follow me. young or old, regardless of your educational, economic, ethnic background, none of that matters. Jesus calls every one of us, follow me. Will you? Turn in your hymnals, if you would, to hymn number 385. Hymn number 385, and draw your attention to the second verse. Would you have him make you free and follow at his call? Would you know the peace that comes by giving all? Would you have him save you so that you need not never fall? Let him have his way with thee. His power can make you what you ought to be. His blood can cleanse your heart and make you free. His love can fill your soul, and you will see 'twas best for him to have his way with thee. What about you this morning? Is Jesus having his way in your life? It's not too late. I don't care how old you are. If you have not responded to the call to follow Jesus, you can this day. Let's stand together as we sing that second verse.